Seriously Sober. Hey, hey, welcome back to another episode of Seriously Sober. I'm Donnell and I have issues for sure. Today, I'm so excited. We are bringing on a mental health comedian, Frank King, and so excited. Anyway, hi, Frank, how you doing?
I'm seriously sober, thank you. I must say though, when I worked in comedy clubs, you know, just a reasonable amount of alcohol did make the show go, but there is a line when you cross, and then, you know, then it becomes disruptive, but, you know, that's to grease the wheels of comedy oftentimes, because I've done some sober events, and it is a little more difficult to get them, you know, it's like driving a car with a clutch, and you're not giving it quite enough gas.
Yeah, I haven't been to a comedy club in years, hence, I haven't been to one since I've been sober. And I can imagine that would be a lot different because I used to get tanked. So yeah, I'm sure you saw a lot of really crazy things.
Oh, you know what it gave me the ability to do is work with drunks, not as in therapy, but when you run across somebody who is intoxicated for whatever reason, at what, you know, sometimes at a corporate event, people, you know, they over imbibe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm so used to handling drunks, you know, during the show, post-show, that it's, you know, I've had people say to me, how do you keep your cool? How do you, it's a gift.
Oh, first, it would have to be a gift. I think about all of the stuff that I did, and I'm like, oh, whoever dealt with me, God bless them, right? So, okay, let's get to the elephant in the room. I described you as a mental health comedian. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mention you really focus on suicide prevention and awareness. So, elephant in the room, how is that funny?
Okay. Well, and before we go any farther, we should give your listeners a trigger warning. We're going to talk about some serious subjects that elicit strong emotions. And so, you know, don't feel bad if you have to tune out or whatever, because we're going to be talking about depression and thoughts of suicide, and not graphically, but in general, and it can be disturbing. I think a comedian's a good choice. Tell you why. The world's first comedians were the court jesters, and their job was to speak truth to power on behalf of the powerless with humor. And I believe I speak truth to the power of mental illness on behalf of those often powerless in its grip with humor. Number two, I believe where there's humor, there's hope. Where there's laughter, there is life, and nobody dies laughing. And number three, depression and suicide run in my family. My grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days. And I myself have come close enough to dying by suicide. I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like. So, by the way, spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. Yeah, and that usually gets a nervous laugh from the audience. And I followed up with a story about a friend of mine who came to my keynote, and he never heard me say the words, I didn't pull the trigger. So he came up, I think he was kind of joking, but he goes, hey man, how come you didn't pull the trigger? I go, hey man, could you try to sound slightly less disappointed?
Right. Yeah.
That's where the humor is in my suicide prevention work. It's not jokes, it's funny personal anecdotes about my mental health journey.
Yeah, I like that. You know, I've talked to people before, and a lot of times, you know, I'll be in the rooms of any kind of 12-step program, and you know, I'll say something that I did that I feel like would be so off the wall, you know, and that's like hilarious to people because they relate. Yeah, when they're in the rooms, it's nice to have people to relate to. So, you know, you doing this is it's an amazing, you know, way to get across to people.
Well, and when I say I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like, it's interesting. It's an interesting sociological experiment to watch the audience, because the people who have mental illness lean in. Oh my Lord, he gets it. The people who are neurotypical, like, oh dear God. Yeah.
The normies,
yes. And by the way, I do, part of my keynote is for the people with mental illness, and part of it is to decode mental illness for the normies. I mean, people say to me, how could life be so bad that you want to kill yourself? And my standard response is, I did not want to kill myself. I simply wanted to end the pain. And most people, that's the case.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of times too, with substance abuse, in my case, alcohol, you know, I wanted to live, right? But I wanted the pain to end. And that's a good segue of, you know, how suicide can relate to alcoholism or substance abuse. I know for me, at the end of my drinking career, hopefully, I definitely, I didn't care if I lived or died, right? Because I felt like such a failure that it didn't matter if I was here anymore, right? It didn't matter if my kids had a mom, and that just didn't matter. Your mind gets such, it gets so twisted.
Well, part of that is something called burdensomeness. Burdensomeness. It's one of the three legs of the suicidality stool. One is social isolation. Two is you've crossed a barrier, you're willing to do it. And number three is a sense of burdensomeness. And you hear people say this all the time. I believe that my family would be better off without me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I said that. I mean.
Yeah. And people think. I felt that. People say suicide's a selfish act. Well, not from the outside. I mean, the inside looking out. From the outside looking in, yes. But from the inside looking out, people say, didn't you think about the people you leave behind? Oh, yeah. That was part of my calculation. These people would be better off without me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Irrational, but still, that's the burdensomeness.
Yeah, totally. I felt that for sure. How do you feel about the substance abuse, suicide? When you think about those two things, what do you think about? Like, what comes together through your mind?
Well, you know, there are people who have substance abuse disorder, alcoholism or drug addiction, as we used to say, and they're just junkies. I mean, you know, there's no mental illness, there's no underlying, there's no comorbidity. I mean, they're just, you know, there are some people who are just drunks or some people who are just drug addicts. Then, of course, there are those who use those medications to, like you said, to kill the pain. I've got a client who was, I think he was the only Indian family in a town in Canada. He's Sikh, which is, you know, that religion. There was only, I think there were like six of them in town. And he had a speech impediment and he had Tourette's. And so he discovered that by drinking, the Tourette's disappeared, you know, his social anxiety disappeared. And I guess his speech impediment was probably still there, but, you know, two out of three going, not bad.
Right.
That's how he got started down that slippery slope. So, you know, you have a wide variety of, could be mental illness, could be Tourette's, could be, you know, lack of self-esteem due to a speech impediment. And the alcohol makes that all, at least for a time, go away, or at least manageable. And I've had people, I have friends with schizoaffective disorder who hear voices. And, you know, after a couple of six packs, voices shut up. So it works for a time. It's not a good long-term strategy, but
yeah.
I certainly understand why one would do that. You know, it's interesting though that you would never take an antipsychotic, but I'll drink 2 6-packs of beer. Okay.
Well, it's legal, you know, so.
Yeah. And, you know, and commercially, you know, from the time we're born, we're seeing commercials for beer or whatever spirits, you know, and it's a party and, you know, it's not a so-and-so without Budweiser and it's, you know. So yeah, socially acceptable, legal. It's like gambling. I've got a client who's gambling at it. And he said, Frank, you know, you start out when you're 8 or 9 years old in elementary school, filling out your brackets for the NCAA tournament. Seems innocuous enough. And he said, for the vast majority of people, it is. For those of us who are susceptible to becoming addicted, it is terribly dangerous. Because it goes from there to the casino when he turned 18. And when I met him, he had lost $1 million, literally, not all of his own. So, but in rehab and doing very well, we're going to do a TEDx on gambling. And I said to him, you know, you need to teach those of us who don't have a gambling problem what it looks like so they can spot it if they have a friend or family member. He said, yeah, Frank, because I'm good at hiding it. I'm good at covering up. I said, that's what they need. They need the information on how to get through that and see what's really happening.
Yeah, that would be incredible, because I would have no idea. But, you know, like most people that are addicted to something, they're really great at hiding it, right? So especially for me, I would, towards the end, I thought I was hiding it, but I could really, you know, I could really, I could put a whole bottle like this. I'm drinking out of like a Yeti cup, right? A whole bottle of wine fits in this Yeti cup, right? So like I would walk around, like that was the acceptable like mom wine culture thing to do. But yeah, you get real creative for sure.
Yeah, so if he could tip them off on these are signs and symptoms, you know, because he said he was really good at hiding it and misdirection and you know, handling questions and, you know, that kind of thing. And eventually something stupid that caught up with him. He was a contractor, he rented a bulldozer, which is probably like a $75,000 machine from a rental yard, and then he sold it for $5,000 or something. Well, you know, it's got serial numbers all over it. I mean, it's not right. Likely that I can figure out whose bulldozer it is. Guy calls the cops and says, look, this guy just sold me a $75,000 bulldozer for $5,000. I think there's something up. That's how he got caught.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and here's something I found interesting. It's not the laying of the bet, winning or losing, that causes the dopamine rush for him. It's acquiring the money to make the bet.
Huh, interesting.
Yep. Acquiring the money to make the next bet was really the rush for him.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, if you really like break it down, I can get that. I can feel that for sure.
Never occurred to me though. I thought it was, you know, you win or, you know.
And you win or you lose, yeah.
And you tell yourself, well, if you win this big score, you're gonna pay off all of that and then stop, and of course.
Right, yeah. I do that too, like, these little apps on the phone, iPhone and stuff. I have this a game called Cube, and it's essentially like Tetris, you know, and I will sit there, but you play for money. Like it's like 60 cents. And if you win, you win $1, right? So it can add up. But like, I'm telling you what, I will sit there. It's terrible. I need to work on this. I'll sit there from 1 o'clock in the morning till like 2:30, and I'll be like, okay. All right, but I go through that cycle. Okay, just one more. It'll be fine. If I win, I'll stop, and then I'll lose, right? It's, yeah.
Well, I discovered Tetris. Oh, my God. I'm like you. I could do it for hours.
Listen, and when I win, I'm getting really good at it, too. So, you know, when I win, I think I'm just amazing.
Well, you are amazing, Donna.
Oh, thanks. So what are you working on? I know you're working on all kinds of things, but what's the most exciting thing that you're working on right now for your career?
TEDx number 7, 8, and 9.
Awesome.
I have ideas and, you know, I have three ideas I'm pitching now. One is, how the coronavirus and the cancel culture killed my comedy career. You probably don't know this, but back in February of 20, I was in Cambodia on one of those two cruise ships. It was in the Southern Pacific, right off the coast of China. Mm-hmm. The Diamond Princess was ravaged by COVID. I mean, you know, I don't know how many cases. They were quarantined off the coast of Japan for several weeks. I was on the other ship, the Holland America ship, and we never let anybody on from mainland China, so none of the 2,500 passengers and crew ever caught it. So my contract was up, and I had two engagements coming up the next week in the U.S. I wasn't sure when Holland America was going to fly me home. So I just bought a plane ticket, left, and made the mistake of speaking to the media when I got back. Somebody tipped them off I was coming from that area of the world. And, you know, every article you see about me says, comedian jumps quarantine. No matter how many times I told them we were never quarantined, that gets clicks and eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if you look up Frank King coronavirus or Frank King coronavirus quarantine or comedian, Frank King comedian quarantine, first thing you see is Time Magazine, then Newsweek, then The Independent, then The Daily in London, the New York Post. I mean, it was just.
Oh, little word.
Here. So that's one of them. The second one is Gay in My DNA. both my parents' mother and father were gay. And there is some science that if you have two gay parents, that the siblings, the children will be better than a 50-50 chance that they'll be gay. But my sister and I are both straight. But I love Judy Garland, tasteful decorations, and I have an amazing ability to accessorize. So I think I'm like 1% gay.
I like it. Cool.
The trick for me, and this is apropos of our conversation, the trick for me is never get 99% drunk.
Right?
Dangerous.
Yes, it would.
The third one, my favorite, is Mental Health and the Orgasm: Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly.
Ooh.
Yes.
That's
not every TEDx committee is going to like that, but somebody's going to think that's the best thing they ever heard. There's a cat going by, sorry.
I see a cat, yeah.
One of 10. Oh, so anyway, that's what I'm, and I've got TEDx coaching clients. I've got a couple of dozen TEDx coaching clients, and about every 2 or 3 weeks, one of them scores a TEDx talk. So, I help them apply and audition and then create the talk. And then a lot of them want to be speakers. So then we take that talk at 12, 18 minutes and blow it up to a 45 minute keynote that they can sell, something that's bookable. And so that's a lot of fun. Very, it's a creative process. It's because the TEDx committees get a couple hundred applications. So whatever you put on that app better be creative, better grab their attention.
Yeah, totally.
I was just with a client and she works in suicide prevention and she wants to do a talk on, the social media, how social media is basically a highlight reel of your life. It's not really your life.
Right.
And also how it affects human interactions. Because you're not looking the person in the face, you're looking into your phone, more often than not. And so the title we came up with was Human Interaction. There's no app for that.
I like that.
Yeah, because and the odd thing is, and I realized this today, in a text or an email or whatever, we've been trying to inject emotion back into that format with emojis.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why? Just skip the emoji, give them a call, or go have a cup of coffee.
Yeah. That's like not really heard of nowadays.
No. Somebody said, the day will come when some young person has another young person they're with who's had some kind of tragedy. And they won't know what expression to put on their face, after they're told there's this tragedy. However, they will know exactly which emoji to use.
Yeah. I mean, it's so true. It's crazy. Well, that's so exciting. I love the background that you have on your video, this TEDx.
Subtle.
So subtle. I don't even hardly notice it. I just saw that. Anyway, it's really cool. I'm kind of talking about maybe getting a TEDx going. And I have had kids here for the past 2 weeks, right? So I usually, we do shared parenting. So I either have the one baby, which is James and I's, or we have four kids. So like the whole blended deal, we've had that for 2 weeks. So I haven't yet sat down to get creative. But I am so excited to do so. Like, I'm just like so humbled, but.
Well, yeah. And you have a TEDx is basically this. First third is your heroine's journey, your messes and stresses. And it sounds like you've got plenty of those.
Yeah, right.
More than your share. And the middle third is, okay, now here's what I learned in all that. And the last third is, now, here's what I'm going to teach you. Because the committee is always interested in what you're going to teach their audience. How are you going to make them better? What can they do after they hear you speak they couldn't do before?
Yeah.
So I think you've got all the elements.
Yeah.
Because you've done some speaking in the recovery space or the treatment recovery space.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, so and most people who are in recovery or treatment, or 12-step or whatever, over any length of time, because they're speaking so often, if they want to and tell their story, that they're pretty well practiced by the time it comes time to charge money for it.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just, oh man, I'm so excited. So you, I was reading up about you a bit.
Oh boy.
I know, I'm kind of a stalker.
Yeah.
You were obviously a comedian. But I saw that you worked for 20 years, Tonight Show, Leno. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Well, when he was just subbing for Johnny Carson back in the dark ages, Johnny would come up on a Friday night, tell his staff, I'm taking next week off. Well, that meant Jay had four nights to cover, because Monday was always a rerun of Best of Carson. But Tuesday through Friday, four nights, Jay had to cover. And he had to have a monologue with 18 jokes per monologue, four times 18. And he had about a weekend to put it together. And so he started contracting with Road Comics, because this is 84 to 94, 85 to 95. During the comedy club boom, there was hundreds of us on the road. And you become an independent contractor, and I'd submit a dozen, two dozen jokes a day. And if he used it, then he would send you $50. And so that's how I got started. Then when he got the Tonight Show job for real, he let most of the contract labor go. But he kept a few of us on to continue writing until the day he moved over to CNBC. So, any nice guy. When I had my first aortic valve replacement, on my answering machine, somebody told Leno I was in the hospital having heart surgery. So on my answering machine, first message, hey, it's Jay Leno, heard you had heart surgery. You think you didn't have it in LA, they take it out and leave it out. So, you know, a guy who's really busy, obviously.
Yeah. I'm sure
the to-do list was yards long. Took time out of his day, you know, no profit to him, just to call and say, hey, you know, thinking about you, get well. So
that's super fun.
Good quality guy.
Awesome. That's so important to do. Like, I feel like you did that with me, especially, and I told you I was kind of talking about doing some TEDx stuff. You know, really took the time to help me out with some things. So again, appreciate you for that.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, you know, it's all about, I just had a conversation with a guy who teaches networking. And, you know, it's all about giving value first without expectation of return. That's, I think, the heart and soul of networking. You don't think about what you can do for me, but what can I do for you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I go about my life in general like that, you know, even if it's just a complete stranger, you know, what can I do for them?
Yeah. I mean, I told my client and I were talking, and we're talking about, I can't remember how I got them. It was about the facial expressions and body language, how you can tell sometimes in a store if somebody is struggling to find something just by the way they're standing or the way they're looking at the counter. Yeah. And so I'll go over, what are you looking for, man? Baby aspirin. They don't call it that anymore. It's called 81 milligrams. Go a little hard on it. Oh, yeah, there it is. So I got in the habit of that because wherever I go, Donnell, however I am dressed, people think I work there. My wife didn't believe me until we're at Home Depot. I'm wearing shorts, a ball cap, a tank top, flip-flops. Guy walks right up to me and goes, hey, man, where do you keep your lawnmower? I said to myself, in my garage, but that's not what he wants to know. I walked him over to Home and Garden because I stopped telling people I don't work there because it just makes them mad.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll be in a store and I'll hear somebody staring at me. I turn to look and I'll start laughing. She goes, why are you laughing? I said, you think I work here? You don't.
What do you think it is about you that people think you work everywhere?
I don't, it's something about maybe it's an openness in my face, my expression. Well, I will tell you what I discovered one day. I was walking through somewhere and then off to my right were full length mirrors, the length of the wall. And I turned and was watching myself walk and I go, that's why you walk around like you own the place.
Oh boy. Hey, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Here's a joke I wrote. I could be standing in a jewelry store wearing cowboy boots, a jock strap, and a football helmet. And somebody would come up and go, you work here? Yeah, it's casual Friday. How can I help you?
Oh, man. I'm telling you. That's so funny. Yeah. Tell me about your wife. She sounds lovely. You guys have had like a lot, like, didn't you travel a lot and you were doing together?
84, fall of 85, she was my girlfriend. We're living together. And I said to her, look, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comic professionally. Do you want to come along for the ride? Thinking she'd say, oh, hell no. And she goes, yeah. So we put all our stuff in storage, gave up the apartment, both our jobs, jumped in my tiny Dodge Colt. And we were on the road together for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop, 7 years and change, comedy club to comedy club. And she was just along for the ride. And we had a ball. I worked with Dennis Miller and Foxworthy and Ellen DeGeneres and Rosie and Ron White and Adam Sandler and Kevin James, back when they were just comics, Dr. Ken Jeong.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and there's a woman who's on a show. There are two women on a show, Good Girls or something, I think. It's on NBC. Retta is her name. She's a Black woman. Uh-huh. And she started comedy in Raleigh, where I was running a radio station at the time. Anyway, we were on the road. Then I got a radio job in Raleigh. So we settled in. That's my old hometown. And then that lasted about 18 months. And when my wife, then my girlfriend, all she asked about the trip, the road trip, she goes, listen, when we get done, can we just come back to San Diego? I'm sure. I had no idea we'd be on the road quite that long without a home, but it just worked out that way. So in 95, 96, we went back to San Diego. And because, you know, I fly pretty much wherever I work. So it doesn't really matter. As long as it's an airport, I can live just about anywhere. So
yeah.
And San Diego is where we met. Oh, and we met in a grocery store.
Did she think you worked there?
No. As a matter of fact, nobody ever asked that. Good question. No, I walked in, saw her. She was checking. She was putting her stuff on the conveyor belt. And I thought, man, hello. So I quick made my purchases using Express Lane. And she went outside. And San Diego, the weather's nice. She used to ride her bike to the store, had bike bags on the back where she put her groceries. And so she's sitting down on the bench, stuffing the bike bags. And I had gotten my business cards printed. I picked them up that day, my comedy business cards. And I just walked up to her and I created this in my mind. Here's a great pickup line, I think. Walked up to her, coughed so she would look up. When she looked up, I handed her my business card and I said, if you ever need a laugh, give me a call. And I walked away. You know, it's not, hey, baby, let's go. You know, it's just here.
Yeah.
She calls, thought it was a joke line. And it turned out to be my answering machine. She left her work number, good girl. And we arranged a date. Well, here's the backstory. The grocery store is in a tremendously gay neighborhood in San Diego, the largest concentration of gays outside of the Bay Area. And there are a lot of those sort of male impersonator bars, La Caja Full sort of boys will be girls, bars around. She's very muscular, tall, ton of makeup, false eyelashes, gorgeous, way out of my league. And I began to worry.
Right. Naturally.
Does she have outdoor or indoor plumbing? So I told my roommate, I said, here's her address and phone number. If you don't hear from me by midnight, send the cops because I'll be playing the crying game and losing. Well, it turned out she's a bodybuilder. That's why she was built that way.
Okay.
Yeah. So at 11:45, excuse me, I said to her, can I borrow your phone? She goes, sure. She handed me the old portable phone. I called my roommate. I'm standing there looking right at her. And I said to my roommate, simply, it's a girl. Of course, I had to explain to Wendy, you know, what that was all about.
Yeah.
Fortunately, she has an amazing sense of humor. I mean, just she's one of the funniest people I know. And I know a lot of funny people.
Right. I'm sure you do. Yeah.
Just very, you know, it's always a play on words or she picked up on something you said and twisted it around. You know, she's just really good. I gave her a nice L.L. Bean. It's called a Weekender. Corduroy on the outside, wool lining, you know, kind of a car coat. And when we first started dating. And she goes, oh, wow, this is really nice. It's the only thing that a guy's ever given me I didn't have to get treated for. That's my lovely one.
I like that. Sounds like my kind of lady. I like it.
Yeah, and, you know, in 2010, we declared Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Lost everything. And that's the kind of thing that either makes a marriage, drives you closer together, or blows it completely up.
Oh, for sure.
Fortunately, we were able to hold it together and grow stronger. And the great thing about bankruptcy, if there's a great thing, is you drill down to what you need, not what you want.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a house and a couple of cars, clothes, and a bunch of animals. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I think about that quite a bit, actually, because I'm constantly on, you know, Facebook Marketplace or, you know, looking at different palette shops, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll take that. And then I'm like, shit, I don't need all of this stuff. I don't use it. You know, that's how you just accumulate a bunch of shit in your house. And I'm trying to live more like frugal and like contain myself. Because I also have ADHD. So I always think, oh yeah, I'll get that. And then I'll upsell it or I'll get that and I'll create something. I always want to create stuff. And oh gosh, I used to quiet that with alcohol as well. But now I just embrace it.
Well, and what I do is I put it in the shopping cart. Yeah. I don't buy at that moment. And then I wait a couple of days and I look back, oh, you know, I've already got a headset. I really don't need that. You know.
Yeah, I do that too. Or I'll like see that there's no free shipping. And I'm like, yep, nope. Nope, it doesn't happen that way.
Okay. No. Yeah, Amazon's amazing with the free shipping. I mean, we got some stuff that weighed a hairy ton and it's free
shipping. Yeah, well, and probably where you're located, Amazon Prime really is Amazon Prime, right? Like, oh. It takes like a good 4 days to get our product, even if we are Prime. Just because we live in the middle of nowhere. So, yeah, it's terrible. So, where can the listeners find you online?
I'm in witness protection. It's TheMentalHealthComedian.com. The, or as we said down south, TheMentalHealthComedian.com. Yes, and if they go there, we have a series of books on men's mental health that I've co-authored. Three of them are on Amazon. The first one, I'm doing the narration, and so I had them create an MP3 copy for me to put on my website so people can put in an email address, get it for free. So it's the unabridged first volume of, it's called Guts, Grit, and the Grind, a mental mechanics manual. So for men, we may look at an automobile owner's manual so guys will pick it up.
Yeah, I was actually really excited. I want to hear that or read it, whichever. I'll probably listen to it. A lot of women, I think, are going to want to listen to that.
You know, we did the analytics we've seen, we sold more to women.
Yeah, I could see that.
They've got a man in their life, brother, father, son, cousin, whatever. I got turned down by a woman's podcast. She goes, well, Frank, all my listeners are women. I said, I don't suppose they have a man in their life, father, brother, husband, cousin, whatever, that may be struggling. She still wouldn't have me on. I thought, like, okay.
Well, whatever.
You can come up here. Men are hard. We asked men what their top 10 problems were and asked women what they thought men's top 10 problems were. And the roughly the same, but different order, you know, money, whatever. Then we asked women what they thought men wanted in the way of help. And then we asked men what they wanted in the way of help. And the lists were completely different.
Really?
So even though the woman wants to help, she's not bringing to the table anything that the man in a form that the man wants. So that was the impetus of the book, was to decode that for men and for women.
Yeah.
Encourage men to come out, because 8 out of 10 people who die by suicide these days are men. And so we thought, you know, it's an epidemic. So we need to, it's a manual. It's got resources and exercises and stories, like 12 stories, sort of chicken soup for the soul. Each guy has a different issue. One may be substance abuse disorder, gambling addiction, divorce, bankruptcy, you know, each one has a different, and what the men wanted was real men, real problems, and how they're really coping.
Not
pie in the sky solutions, but how these guys actually getting by day to day.
Yeah, like so real vulnerable.
Yes. That's how we met. We were hoping to get 12 guys, figuring most guys wouldn't want to talk about it. We got 64, so one book became 4 books.
That's amazing, though. That's great.
I was amazed that many guys were willing to come forward and bare their souls and, you know, in effort to help other men and women, of course.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think that hopefully the stigma of all of this stuff, you know, all of these mental health issues, substance abuse issues, suicidal ideologies, I'm hoping the stigma is not as big of a deal as it used to be. Especially like with the Olympics going on, right? I hear a lot of talk about mental health. You know, they've got to focus on their mental health, and athletes, you know, they talk about what they go through, and you just never used to hear that even 5 years ago. So I'm so excited to be hearing that stuff like on the media.
Well, Simone Biles backed out of several events to maintain her mental health. I mean, and some people ridiculed her for it. Said, you know, what is she doing representing America? But, you know, like you said, in the past, nobody would have talked about that.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they would have made up some other excuse why the person wasn't there.
Yeah. And it's like, why? Why, you know, why would you lie about it? Or, you know, but I think the people And I could be wrong. I think the people that are ridiculing her for it, they don't really have, you know, they don't have to deal with the mental health issues, right? Like people get it if they have the issues. Like they're like, yeah, I'm like rooting her on, like, way to go, girl. Like, yeah. Set your boundaries, which it's so important.
Well, and I speak on, you know, suicide prevention, but most often they tell me, we brought you in here to start the conversation on suicide. Because what happens is when I go up and, you know, I'm vulnerable and I tell my story and I get a little choked up, it gives other people permission to give voice to their feelings and experiences surrounding depression and suicide. And I do a Q&A generally, you know, for everybody. And I tell them, look, if you don't want to ask a question in the middle of this, you know, general Q&A, you don't want to, you know, hey, I'm crazy, can you help me? I'll hang out as long as it takes to answer everybody's individual questions. And sometimes it's two people and sometimes it's eight. They want to tell a story or share a story or need help for a loved one or something. So but I give them permission to, you know, to do those things by getting up and talking about them.
Yeah. Yeah. I just love that. You're breaking that stigma of, you know, I can't remember how you worded it, but basically mental health issues are more of an ability, right, than a disability.
Yeah, because I believe my comedic ability, creativity, imagination, just flip side of my depression, thoughts, and suicide. Same brain. And I did a whole TED talk on it called Mental with Benefits, the Evolutionary Advantages of Mental Illness. Because I kept bumping into people who were mentally ill, but amazingly talented in some other area.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea is to reframe mental illness from simply a disability to a combination of disability and ability. So yeah. You treat the disability and you wrap your arms around and energize whatever ability it is.
Yeah.
Especially with kids. You know, to look.
Yeah, we were talking about that the other day. You know, like children with ADHD, how you teach them, how you should, yes. You know. So yeah, you can get into that if you want.
Yeah, I think the IEP should be, the individual education plan should be truly individual.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
Not every kid's at 6 years old ready for first grade. You know, not every, some should be in at five, some should wait till seven. I mean, it's kind of a cookie cutter process. And the teaching method is the same pretty much for every kid. And that's, you know, not everybody learns the same way.
Yeah, you had a friend that was a teacher and he did kind of a little experiment with
the teacher. He said, Frank, my ADHD kids and ADD kids, most talented. Problem is, if you strap them in a chair for 50 minutes and make them practice, first 10 minutes they get better, next 40 minutes, they're just using all their energy to sit still. Mm-hmm. So he thought, you know what? I'll get an egg timer. He got an egg timer. He set it for 10 minutes. Said, look, you know, play your scales for 10 minutes. Egg timer goes off. Okay, now let's practice our breathing for 10 minutes. Egg timer goes off. Now let's practice those two pieces of the concert Saturday for 10 minutes. And they got immeasurably better more quickly because they knew it's coming to an end in 10 minutes. You know, it's just, so I think the teaching methods, not only the curriculum, but the teaching methods should match the child's abilities.
Absolutely. First, like I said before, I have ADHD and I can do lots of things and I can do them really well. Okay. I promise, but you've got to let me do them in little bursts. Like I get that. So, you have also, you talked a bit about your books. Are there any top books that you would think would be ideal for our listeners to hear or to read?
There's one called, if you're living with bipolar disorder, there's one called The Bipolar Advantage. Again, a combination of ability and disability. Alexander Hamilton, they believe, is bipolar, really? Based on his writings and historical records. Extremely productive in long days. And then would crash and burn. Hypersexual, all the sort of telltale signs of bipolar disorder. So that's a good one. Okay. And it talks about how America, Canada, and Australia have the highest rates of bipolar disorder. And he believes because they're immigrant nations, because the people back in the day when sea voyages were terribly dangerous, only the manic, you know, the let's go, who cares, nothing's gonna go wrong. Those people sailed to wherever, you know, and then so then you got these people mating with this with other people with bipolar disorder. So
that's interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
That's why I like the book. That's if you want to be a public speaker, the book I recommend is The Message of You, The Message of You by Judy Carter.
Yes.
If you want to be funny, Judy Carter also wrote The Comedy Bible. It's a great way to get started in comedy.
I love it. So if you, this is kind of a loaded question. I should have asked you before we recorded.
Oh, no, I got no secrets. No,
it's not like a, okay. So if you could have dinner with three people, dead or alive, who would they be?
I like the question better, alive or dead. Well, definitely alive.
Well, you know what I mean.
Yeah. One would be Chris Anderson, the guy who's in charge of TED. Because it's one of my TED Talks they refused to post, and it wouldn't tell me why. They wouldn't edit it. They wouldn't put an editor's note on it. They just wouldn't post it and wouldn't tell me why. So I want to ask Chris, okay, Chris, what was wrong with that talk? Because I got a standing ovation. It was my mental health and the orgasm one.
Yes. So I can't hear it anywhere?
No, it doesn't exist. And I will never do another TEDx unless I have somebody in the audience with an iPhone recording me. Yeah. I want to have a copy. I'm not going to put it up on YouTube, but I want it for my own promotional, you know. Yeah, my mistake. Yeah.
Dang it. Yeah.
Let's see. So Chris Anderson, alive. Good question. Leno, I think, because we've met passing, had, you know, chatted briefly here and there, but it'd be fun to, he's a regular guy. He's the kind of guy you would want to come home and have Thanksgiving dinner with the family.
Okay, yeah.
You know, even though, and whereas somebody like David Letterman, kind of prickly, you really don't want to bring him home. But Leno, I'm sure the stories he has to tell are undoubtedly amazing.
Oh, Lord, I'm sure, yeah.
And Barack Obama, I think, would be a fascinating dinner guest.
Yeah.
Love his sense of humor. You know, it's barbed every now and then. Now he's not president, doesn't have to bite his tongue quite so hard.
Yeah, they seem like a really cool family. I think I would hang out with them as well.
Yeah, when he was down in South Carolina after that church massacre and broke into Amazing Grace, singing it from the pulpit. Oh, man, just tore me out of my tree.
Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, the compassion, the pain he felt. I mean, it was just... Yeah. Yeah. He was up there and he was speaking at he's doing the eulogy for the folks who died at that African-American church in South Carolina, shot by Dylan Root. And I guess at one point he just stopped and he broke into Amazing Grace. And I was just transfixed.
That's such a cool thing to experience.
Yeah. It was just, it seemed like, yeah, just a down to earth, genuine, you know?
Yeah. I think about stuff like that. Like, when I was drinking, had that happened, I wouldn't even remember it. Like, how sad is that? I think about all of the things that I missed out on in life, dude. Like, you know, I'm a mom. Like, it's just incredible how I mom now as opposed to
then.
Yeah, thank God I got better.
Well, and I've got a friend who works for an entertainment booking company in San Diego. And they had me on the podcast, of course, talking about mental health work. And she told me, and I think everybody, her boss and anybody else who could hear for the first time ever, that she had had postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, I wish I could have been there for the first 3 months of my daughter's life. Now, she was there physically, mm-hmm. but she wasn't there. It's called presenteeism. You're present physically, but your brain is somewhere entirely different.
Yeah, I had postpartum with my first daughter, and I think it was a big fear thing. I grew up without a mom because she passed away drinking and driving. And I think it was just fear. Like, I grew up with my grandma, but not a mom.
Right.
I didn't have my mom. And so I'm like, I don't know how to be a mom, you know, and I start freaking out. But yeah, that is real. And it's really scary, like the panic attacks and the things that go on with that. I started drinking too, to numb that too. So that, you know, it's just a big snowball effect.
Yes. Well, I have one last story. We've only got 5 or 6 minutes. I had an aunt, my uncle, my mother's brother's wife, raging alcoholic, and finally got sober, thank goodness, in her 50s, I think, which is remarkable at that age. You know, it's a lifestyle at some point. But she was a little quirky. So they came to the comedy show in D.C. where they live. They came out to see me the first time they ever seen me do comedy. And after the show, we all sat down at a table. And the cocktail waitress came over and said, would you like an after shift? And I didn't drink a lot, but, you know, I'd have a rum and coke or something silly. And, well, my aunt, part of her recovery, she carried around a doll, a Kermit the Frog doll, wearing a Panama hat. And she had a fan chair and she set it up on the... So there sits Kermit on the end of the table with all the rest of us. He's got his little green legs crossed. So... as the cocktail waitress is coming up, I'm looking at Kermit. And the rest of the family's going, like, don't mention it. So the cocktail waitress says, would you like an after shift, Frank? I go, yeah, bring me a rum and coke. And I turned to Kermit and said, and I'll have a grasshopper for my friend. Oh, man. Oh, the family actually laughed.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, they were really worried what I was going to say. I mean, comic, and there's a frog on the table, and, you know.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I love it. Well, Frank, thank you so much for your time. I'm so excited to get this up. I will put a link to your website in the Instagram post, so you guys stay tuned for that. If you guys are not friends with me on Instagram, it is at Sober Seriously. And Frank, do you have an Instagram handle you'd like to share?
Yes. The Mental Health Comedian.
The Mental Health
Comedian. At the Mental Health Comedian.
Awesome. All right.
Or maybe at Mental Health Comedian. I'm not sure the "the" is in there. We'll see. Either way. And here's my phone number. I always give this out. 858-405-5653. 858-405-5653. Because if you're suicidal, call the Lifeline. If you're just having a bad day, call a crazy person. Now you have my cell number.
I love it. We are definitely tribe mates for sure. So thank you so much. I'm just so excited to keep breaking stigmas with you.
Oh, yeah. So I want to make it as easy as talking about sports and the weather.
It should be. Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, have a good weekend.
Thanks. You guys do too.
All right. Bye.